All rise. The Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case is 2018-1209, Rebecca Buddenberg versus Robert Weisdeck et al. For the petitioner, counsel.
May it please the court. My name is Frank Scaldone, and I represent the Geauga County defendants and petitioners. I would like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal. We're here on two certified questions from the Federal District Court. One, does ORC Section 230760's creation of a civil cause of action for injuries based on a criminal act require an underlying criminal conviction? And two, is there a criminal conviction, a condition precedent to a civil claim pursuant to ORC Section 2921.03? We'll focus primarily on the first question, but we ask this court to answer yes to both certified questions based on the express text of the statute, the context which those phrases appear in, and the majority of cases that agree that a conviction is required. The first question, RC 230760 uses the phrase criminal act as a prerequisite for civil claim to exist. The text provides that anyone injured by a criminal act may recover in a civil action. Now, we concede that the word conviction is not in 2307.60, but this term is not necessary because the phrase criminal act necessarily addresses conduct for which there has been a conviction or a finding of guilt.
Can't you have a criminal act without a conviction? In fact, it's a condition precedent, isn't it?
You have to have a criminal act
before you can have a conviction.
I believe that the only way that you can have a criminal act, the only way in our system that you can have a criminal act is if there has been a determination by a criminal court that there has been a conviction. Otherwise, it is just conduct.
Don't you think a criminal act is just an act that is defined by the statute as against the law? This is the elements of a criminal act, whether it attaches to a person or not, or whether that person is ever apprehended, there still has been a criminal act committed, such as a murder without a defendant being identified.
Yeah, I disagree with that okay. A criminal act requires there be a conviction. And in this case specifically, the context for which that phrase exists makes that clear. Crime is determined by a criminal court or jury of finding of guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. For a criminal act to have occurred, the civil defendant must have been convicted of crime, not merely the plaintiff's allegation in a complaint.
Counsel, does it matter that the criminal conviction requirement, the standard is higher than civil litigation?
I don't believe it does, because that's what the legislature determined for the requirement, the prerequisite for having a civil cause of action in this context.
Why wouldn't they use the word conviction rather than criminal act if they meant a conviction?
They don't need to. The term criminal act and stuff requires that there's going to be a conviction. And again, the context of the act, in addition to the use of the term criminal act, indicates that that's necessary. Here, there's obviously no criminal charges, no findings of probable cause, let alone a conviction that demonstrates a criminal act. Reasonable and sound statutory interpretation must account for the specific context that's used in the broader context of the statute in interpreting what it means, the clues to what that phrase means. Here, criminal act, that phrase is only used twice in this particular section. And the phrase confirms that the phrase refers to a conviction. In A2 of the same section of 230760, which creates a presumption for certain findings critical to sustaining a finding of guilt, the legislature used the phrase criminal act to the situation where a conviction occurred. Now, this is important because this is the only other place in the section where the phrase criminal act is used, and it is used directly to refer to a conviction. Moving on to the context, section B2A is another section that provides a clue to what criminal act means here and clarifies the legislature's meaning. Here, that section prohibits certain civil plaintiffs from recovering under the statute.
Counsel, you would agree that just under the ordinary meaning, as we use the term, someone would say, if you say he committed a criminal act, we don't mean he's been convicted, do we?
I would agree with that, yes.
Okay, well, then, if that's the ordinary meaning of the term, why does any of this other stuff matter?
Well, I think it's critical to be able to determine the context of how that phrase is used. And that determines whether it's unambiguous. And I think when you look at the specific context of how it's used here, the dictionary definitions or how it's used colloquially, it really doesn't indicate what the legislature intended here.
And so you think that there's a special meaning because it's in this statute as opposed to the common parlance of English?
I believe that that's correct, that it's...
You think that's the way statutes...
Well,
Counsel, would you wait till I finish my question?
I'm sorry.
Do you think that's the way statutes are written in code?
I believe that here, when the legislature used criminal to modify act, they intended to demonstrate that a conviction was required. And that's indicated by the way that it's used in A2 and in B2A, where when they're talking about conduct, when they talk about criminal conduct, it's specifically regarding pleading guilty to a felony or being convicted. So it's another clue. But the broader significance or the broader context here, which also demonstrates the legislature would have indicated that a conviction was not required, like it had in other statute, if it intended to authorize hundreds of new claims being injected into the tort system without limitation. Our review of Title 29 of the revised code notes that there's approximately 250 criminal laws that could be form the basis for a civil claim under 230760. When combined with criminal municipal codes, it's hundreds more, possibly thousands. Of those under Title 29, approximately 30 expressly waive the requirement of a conviction. 230761 is an example regarding willful theft, 230.7.62 regarding cable. The legislature used the term criminal act multiple times, but it did not use the phrase alleged criminal act, conduct that if prosecuted would constitute a criminal act, or an act that could be criminally charged, or for which probable cause to believe that a crime occurred, or similar phrase. It used criminal act. The opposition position seems to add terms that don't exist in the statute. Plaintiff relies heavily on Sedema versus IMREX, and that's a Supreme Court case, United States Supreme Court case, that interpreted the Federal RICO Act to provide a civil cause of action. But Sedema actually supports our case because you can see that, well, one, it didn't deal with the phrase criminal act, but it also noted that the statutory language is that all it had to be, the criminal act, rather, all it had to be was chargeable or indictable to create a civil claim. The Ohio legislature could have used that. It did not.
Excuse me. In this case, the narrow issue we're deciding is just whether a civil act can be commenced, right? Started, not whether it has to proceed. For instance, when I left the trial court, I had a civil action that stemmed from an alleged DUI. The criminal case was still proceeding at that time, so the civil case was commenced. We stayed discovery until conviction occurred because people have Fifth Amendment rights, and that throws some hurdles into discovery. But we're just deciding whether a civil act can be commenced, right?
Exactly, yes. Exactly. Further interpreting the unambiguous language, the statutory context with nearby statutes also supports criminal act requiring a conviction. The surrounding statute, 2307.60A1, show that the legislature puts forth with specificity when a conviction is not required to obtain civil relief. For instance, 2307.61 allows for civil action for a theft offense was enacted at the same time that 2307.60 was, and it specifically states that recovery even in the absence of a conviction. The legislature expressly provided that recovery was available, quote, whether or not any person has pleaded guilty to or has been convicted of any criminal offense. That's not in 2307.60, yet they were enacted together. Again, 2307.62, which is civil action for theft of cable services, uses very similar language as that, and premises, well, the language in it is a person may commence a civil action under this section regardless of whether any person who allegedly violated one or more of those divisions has pleaded guilty to or been convicted. So the legislature has shown itself capable and in other statutes, even ones enacted at the same time, of putting that disclaimer. It did not. It used the terminology criminal act, which requires a conviction in our system. Not surprisingly, the majority of the courts that have looked at this have determined that a conviction is required. Now, we understand that these cases really don't spend a lot of time with it, but again, because the phrase criminal act requires a conviction, we don't believe it was really necessary for the court to go into it. It's that plain.
Well, what about the argument that your opponent makes that prior to the statute being amended in 2007, the statute prohibited the use of a criminal conviction as evidence in a civil proceeding? If the use was prohibited, how could you show how could a crime victim ever prove his case?
Right, absolutely. The legislature that's absolutely great. But the legislature in 2006 corrected that glitch in the statute and removed that language.
So that was a glitch in the statute?
It's something. Well, if you look at when the legislature corrected that. Almost uniformly, Ohio courts
did they change the law to make it to allow a presumption to be?
Well, they corrected it in the sense that they removed that phrase from the statute, and the courts up to that point were almost uniformly determining that there was a conviction prerequisite. The legislature certainly would have known of that if they wanted to put into the statute that that a criminal conviction was not necessary. They could have done so, like they had done in 2307.62, 2307.50. I see that I'm down to 3 minutes.
A little less than that.
With regard to the second question, I'll take a few more moments, but with regard to the second question, our interpretation is very straightforward, that the commission of offense under the intimidation statute does not refer, you don't refer to civil matters with the language of using offense. Courts that have analyzed offense in similar statutes, such as 2921.13 falsification, have required a conviction. The Sixth Circuit, relying on an Ohio case, noted that, quote, use of the word offense makes clear that civil liability is predicated on a criminal offense. It does not create a civil liability absent a criminal conviction. Further, this is a section that appears in the criminal code. So I will reserve the remaining two minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you. Counsel?
Thank you, and Chief Justice O'Connor, Justices, may it please the court. My name is Subodh Chandra, and I represent the plaintiff appellee in this case, Rebecca Buddenberg. Our firm first started to get involved in 2307.60 cases when we were looking for remedies for crime victims who didn't have any readily available other civil cause of action available to them. And it started most notably with a mortgage fraud victim for whom we couldn't find any other cause of action. And what I would suggest to the court is that looking at the plain language of both statutes at issue in this case, the plain language, there's simply nothing there that confirms the existence of a conviction requirement. That's the first point. The second is that the structure of these statutes show that a conviction requirement, imposing or writing in a conviction requirement, would then lead to nonsensical results, and I'll elaborate on that. And finally, the purpose and the legislative history show that the General Assembly was intending for crime victims to have expanded rights to be able to pursue a civil remedy without waiting for criminal proceedings to be completed. The most important point I think I can make today is this, that if this court were to write into 2307-60 a conviction requirement that doesn't exist, then the practical effect of what the court would be doing would be the reimposition of British common law in Ohio. Because now a crime victim would have to wait for the whim of a prosecutor to pursue a case. But not only to pursue a case and for it to be completed, it might be worse than British common law, you'd have to wait until there was a conviction on a beyond a reasonable doubt standard before a preponderance of the evidence civil case could be pursued. That simply doesn't make any sense.
If the criminal conviction isn't then required, how is a criminal act determined?
So I think it's the plain and ordinary reading of the words criminal act. And what we see happening in the appellant's briefing is a bit of a switch in the use of the word criminal, because they're touting a noun definition of criminal from Black's Law Dictionary that is referring to someone who's been convicted. But in fact, it's being used as an adjective in the statute. It's a description of the nature of the conduct. And indeed, this goes with the plain language argument, is that if you look at the introduction to the act, not the statute itself, but the introduction of the act that was signed into law, it was talking about recovery for loss for crime victims, quote, arising from any criminal act. You can't give that meaning conviction, because if you turn that into the word conviction, it doesn't make any sense that anybody would have a recovery from a loss arising from a criminal conviction. So you use those words, and I think the example was given by a member of the court here moments ago, that in the plain and ordinary meaning and the way that we talk about these things, we say that somebody's engaged in a criminal act. We don't necessarily imply that they've been convicted of that yet, or even charged for that matter. Now, continuing with this natural reading argument, I think one of the things that you have to look at, if you look at the Black's Law Dictionary from around the time that these statutes were put into effect, you'll see that there's a reference to the external manifestation of one's will, which is a prerequisite to criminal responsibility. That's the definition of criminal act, versus the definition of a conviction, which is the result of a criminal trial that ends in a judgment or sentence that the accused is guilty as charged. They're just two different things. So it would require writing into the statute that which is not there. This court in the Malone case, which we referenced in our briefing, was addressing a previous version of the intimidation statute, and the court itself used that same natural meaning in referring to the words criminal act as referring to saying that the conduct in that case dealt with conduct that occurred after the criminal act, but prior to any proceedings flowing from the criminal act in a court of justice. So even this court has used the words criminal act in their plain and ordinary meaning. There's nothing in the statute that suggests, for example, a separate definition. If you take a look at the Sedema case from the U.S. Supreme Court, that's an example, and I agree, the words criminal act aren't in that statute, but it's the same underlying principle that the word violates in that statute, and that's the word that's used in the other statute at issue before the court today, the 292103. If you're referring to the word violates, you're not talking about or implying a conviction. You're referring to a failure to adhere to legal requirements. So The offense is referring to conduct constituting violations of law, not conviction of that violation. Now, when the General Assembly of our state has wanted to include a conviction requirement, they've shown themselves perfectly capable of doing so. And so an example of that is in Revised Code 2923.31I3, which is providing a definition of corrupt activity. And in that, the statute says, quote, provided the defendant was convicted of the conduct in a criminal proceeding in the other state. When the General Assembly wants to constrict the application of a statute to only a situation involving a conviction, it can do so. Now, I want to turn to the structure of the statute, because I think this will reinforce what I hope will be the court's conclusion on this issue on 230760, and that is this. The appellants have pointed to Section A2 as an example because there are references to convictions there and when they can be used as evidence, and they've said that that somehow highlights the notion that there's a conviction requirement. I would suggest to the court that it does exactly the opposite if you do a structural analysis, because what they're asking for, what the appellants are asking for, is that convictions be written in as an element of the claim. And as you know, Justice Donnelly knows from his time on the trial court, if you're talking about the element of a claim, that's something that's going to be in the jury instructions, or that's going to be something for the fact finder if it's a bench trial, and that's something that's going to have to be proved, that there was a conviction on the statute at issue. And so if that's an element of the claim, how can there be in another portion of the statute an implied prohibition on circumstances on when you can talk about a conviction or not and when you can use it as evidence? You would always have to be able to use it as evidence. And so what would happen if the court wrote in a conviction requirement is that you'd have this kind of nonsensical, first of all, it would lead to floodgates of litigation because no one would understand how to apply the statute. When does the conviction come in? When does it not? How do you prove the conviction, which is now an element of the statute? So it would create a structural problem with the statute that wouldn't work. And similarly, in 292103, the violates this section language is language that's used to describe when someone can be guilty and be civilly liable. That's subpart B and subpart C, respectively. That's the intimidation statute we're talking about. Now, if that language meant that a conviction is required, that would then create this feedback loop, and we talked about this in our brief, where that would mean that one has to have a conviction to be able to have a criminal prosecution. And that, again, creates a nonsensical reading of the statute that the court should not tolerate or impose. Finally, and I don't want to spend too much time on this issue, but I want to turn to the legislative history issue. Justice Kennedy's concurrence in the Jacobson v. Kefouri case actually does a pretty thorough job of laying out the legislative history of the statute. But as was pointed out earlier, in 1985, when creating a cause of action, there was a prohibition on using a conviction as evidence. And then in 2007, when the statute was amended, the General Assembly removed that, didn't add an affirmative conviction requirement. And it's pretty clear, if you look at the history of the statute, that what the General Assembly is trying to do is expand the rights available to crime victims. And if you look at the initial Legislative Services Commission bill analysis of the intimidation statute, 292103, you'll see that they actually corrected an error. They originally said that they were referring to a person convicted of the crime, and then they changed it to a person who violates, further manifesting the intent to ensure that this was protective of crime victims and not subject to the whim of prosecutors. And when I refer to the whim of prosecutors, by the way, I'm turning now to the policy and practical effects, I'm not saying that in a pejorative sense. those of you who are former prosecutors on this bench know, and I'm a former prosecutor, you know that there are many reasons that prosecutors choose not to pursue cases. It may have to do with resource constraints. It may have to do with the evidentiary burden on beyond a reasonable doubt, prosecutorial priorities. There's perfectly benign reasons that prosecutors would choose not to pursue a case, even when a criminal act has occurred. Arguably or otherwise. And so the General Assembly here was trying to expand the remedies available to crime victims, and a prosecution can't give crime victims anything other than raw economic damages. You can't get emotional damages ordered as part of restitution. So if somebody's been a rape victim, there's simply no way to order a financial restitution order for them for what might have been the extreme part of the trauma that they've endured. So, continuing on these practical effects, the Wooten case from this court from 2015 really seals this question, I think, on both statutes. In the Wooten case, this court determined that we're not going to leave civil remedies available to the discretion of prosecutors. And very, very similar circumstances, the statute is virtually identical to the intimidation statute. And other practical effects that would ensue, we talked about this a little bit in our briefing, and I believe the amici from the various crime victims organizations, including the Cleveland Rape Crisis Center, talked about this. We wouldn't know when the statute of limitations really begins or ends. I think this would just multiply litigation, because what you'd have is a situation where do you wait for the initial entry of judgment of conviction, and is that when the statute of limitations begins to accrue? Is it when all appeals are exhausted? What if there's a collateral attack, either in state or federal court, on the conviction? Can you have brought a cause of action legitimately and suddenly your cause of action doesn't exist? And I think one of the biggest negative policy effects, which again underscores the legislative intent here because it would be such a twisted policy effect, which is the issue of issue preclusion. You might have some causes of action that ripen as normal civil causes of action, common law causes of action, statutory causes of action, like Ms. Buddenberg has. But then you'd have some causes of action under 230760 or 292103 that don't ripen. And so if you're going to meet the statute of limitations, you have to go ahead and bring your other claims. And now there will be issues that arise as to whether or not by the time your civil liability for criminal acts claims arise, are those precluded? Are those issue precluded because the first causes of action have already been decided? Are we going to see a multiplicity of litigation where people bring one suit and then they bring another suit later? As those of you who've been trial court judges know, sometimes trial court judges say, no, I'm not letting you amend your complaint anymore, so now you have to bring a separate case. It really shows you that this is not what the General Assembly was intending at all. So unless there are any further questions, I'm actually uncharacteristically have time left. So what I would simply say in summing up is this. On behalf of Ms. Buddenberg, but also as you see from all of the amici from the crime victims organization, the amicus brief from the state of Ohio, which has its own interest in the case because of the opioid litigation and essentially adopts our position, what we request is that the court answer the certified questions in favor of Ms. Buddenberg, in favor of crime victims, in favor of the General Assembly's intent to expand rights that are available to crime victims. And I am concluded. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel, you have saved 2 minutes.
With regard to the Wooten case that was provided as supplemental authority, the Wooten case does not, I mean, the statute involved in that was the treble damages statute for recklessly cutting down timber. The language used in that statute is very different from the statutes at issue here. There's no language that provides the critical language in the intimidation statute. No commission of an offense is not in that statute, and certainly doesn't deal with the criminal act phrase in the primary statute that we've been discussing. So that does not apply or dictate the result here. Justice Stewart, you asked how a crime is proven in one of these cases, and I think that's an interesting, it's interesting because the way I'm playing.
I think I said criminal act, but go, yeah. But go ahead.
I'm playing it out in my head of you've got a civil claim that's coming. Let's say that there's no conviction required. So they come forward and they demonstrate by a preponderance of evidence, a civil, you know, burden, that they're correct. Like, that's what the opposing counsel has been arguing. But you still haven't demonstrated a criminal act because the burden is different in a criminal situation. You'd have beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, let's assume that it's...
The burden doesn't determine what the elements are or what you have to show in a civil act. Just because you have a higher burden in a criminal, you can still show the exact same acts or sequence of acts or activity in your civil case.
But that's not going to demonstrate a criminal act, because a criminal act has to do with a criminal justice system determining
you're
beyond
saying
a
that
reasonable
doubt. There has to be a beyond a reasonable doubt,
yes,
before that's going to be determined that these acts are criminal.
Correct.
So if for some reason you're not prosecuted for an assault and yet you've got a victim who's suffered a concussion, broken legs, et cetera, at the hand of the defendant and that's pursued in a civil action, that's not a criminal act?
Under our system, unless there's been a determination of guilt, it is just an act at that point. It's not a criminal act.
So you can't sue the perpetrator in civil court?
Absolutely, you could. And like pointed out by opposing counsel, I mean, initial intent going back 100 years was that the civil and criminal acts don't get merged. So there are other civil actions that could be brought in your circumstances to sue in a civil claim. But for the legislature determined here to use criminal act, use that phrase multiple times, and the structure of the act as you see it referenced, how it's treated, it's always in reference to a conviction. Otherwise, it's just action. It's not a criminal act. I see that I'm out of time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll take the matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decision.